The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. I'm Laura Kovacs, and I am pleased to be here. Melissa Broder is the author of the novel The Pisces, the essay collection So Sad Today, and four poetry collections. Her awards include a Pushcart Prize for Poetry. Her new novel is a story of forbidden appetites. A reviewer for Vogue writes that the book gathers strands of faith, hunger, queerness, lust, and loneliness, and braids them into a fully risen challah of human experience. This evening, she'll be joined in conversation with Nomi Eve, author and director of the Creative Writing MFA program at Drexel University. And now the screen is all yours.
Hi, so thrilled to be here with you tonight, Melissa. I loved this book. This is an incredibly current feeling book that's also deeply historical, a personal book that's also political, a book about body that's also about soul, about pleasure and pain. It's a devotional book that flirts with sacrilege, a funny book that's also really sad. Really, there are so many opposites that you manage to weave into your storytelling. The pages just glow with an energy of contradictions. I couldn't put it down, and I'm thrilled to be able to chat with you about it. I was wondering if maybe you could start us off with a little reading.
Absolutely. So I will read, I'm just going to read a couple pages from Milk Fed, and just to give a little context, our protagonist, Rachel, is 24, lives in Los Angeles, and deals with disordered eating. She sees the world in time. Her religion is caloric. And every day she goes to a frozen yogurt shop for lunch, and she loves the attendant, the frozen yogurt server there, Adiv, because he asks no questions. He only fills the yogurt up to the lip of the cup, and he does exactly as she likes it. Unfortunately for us, she is confronted with, Adiv is gone one day when she shows up at the frozen yogurt place. And in his place is a woman named Miriam, who is an Orthodox Jew. Rachel is sort of a lapsed Jew. Miriam is a zoftig, voluptuous woman who is completely comfortable with her body. And she begins to peer pressure Rachel into indulging more. And this scene occurs when Rachel returns to the yogurt, and she is delighted to find that Miriam is not at the counter and Adiv is back. A great miracle occurred. Adiv returned. "Shalom," I called out when I saw him behind the counter. "Shalom," he said, looking confused. Never, I was sure, had any customer been so happy to see Adiv back at it. This was my burning bush, my Noah and the Ark and the Dove. I was to be captain of my dessert realm again. No more peer-pressured extras or yogurt in conversation. I wondered how his experience in Israel had been, what his views were. But a food service interaction seemed an inopportune time to say, "Hey, any thoughts on a two-state solution?" "I'll have the cheesecake," I said, omitting any discourse on land disputes. Then Miriam emerged from the back. "Hey, Rachel," she said, signaling that she'd handle me. "Oh, hi," I said. "Be useful and go unbox the pretzel cones," she said to Adiv. Adiv complied. I watched her grab a 16-ounce cup and pull the lever on the machine. The yogurt began its ascent, swirling upward until it overtook the brim, entering the unsafe space above it. But then it transcended that realm, soaring to a new, unthinkable altitude before reaching a summit that was miles above where she began. Even for Miriam's style, the serving was absurd. "I want to give you a free topping," she said, "because you didn't like your last yogurt." "That's okay," I said. "I don't want one." "Come on," she said. "There has to be something you like. What about sprinkles? I'm just going to put sprinkles on it, just a little." "Rainbow," I said instinctively, then thought, fuck. I watched her spooning on the sprinkles and noticed for the first time that she had lovely fingernails, smooth and egg-shaped, trimmed neatly. She wasn't a biter like me, a compulsive habit that began in childhood as something of a snack. Now I painted my nails red as a deterrent, but I only ended up biting off the polish too, spitting flakes of crimson. When she handed me the yogurt, every inch of that mammoth peak was covered in rainbow sprinkles. It was gorgeous, seamless, as though the yogurt were a rainbow itself. No separation between dessert and topping. Its beauty made me think for a moment that it should have always been this way. I stared at the sculptural masterpiece in my hand. I wanted to kiss it, to touch it with my tongue and lips and explore what those tiny textures felt like. Simply holding the cup, I was rocketed back to sprinkles past. I remembered that they were actually made of tiny bits of dried frosting and the way you could dissolve them in your mouth, suck until they were softened back to frosting once again, completing one of life's great cycles of transformation. "See," said Miriam, "everyone loves a topping." I smiled at her and felt weak. Then, as though compelled by an otherworldly force, I brought that majestic mountain to my mouth, licked it, and took a bite. "Mmm," I said with my mouth full. "Thanks." I closed my eyes. The sprinkles were so delicious, melting there on my tongue, that my throat began to call out for them. "What would be the harm? What would be the harm?" said my throat. "What would be the harm so bad about just swallowing?" Of course, I knew what the harm would be. Sprinkles were loaded with sugar, and there was no way of knowing how many of them were packed into any given mouthful. From one bite to the next, it would be impossible to calculate a caloric load. Panicking, I spun on my heel and headed for the door. I hoped that I could keep the concoction in my mouth long enough without swallowing to get to the trash can on the curb. But when I reached the can, my lips would not open to relinquish the mouthful. I stood there and swallowed it down my gullet. Then, to my horror, I found myself sticking my tongue into a crevice between yogurt and cup where a small pile of naked sprinkles had fallen. I licked them out. I didn't stop, but pressed on to where the sprinkles and some drips of melted yogurt had formed a viscous union. I chewed these bites up quickly and swallowed them again and again, as though this were the fastest way to get rid of them. While I ate, I watched myself, like I was hovering up above, split into two beings. One of me was the one doing the eating. The other observed myself in shock as I continued to devour it all. "Stop, stop," called out the observer me, but it was no use. I was consumed by the yogurt, all five senses bathing in its drips and swirls, as though I had entered some yogurt door. No thought, no vision or sound, but the yogurt and its sprinkles. Any fear or hesitation fully eclipsed by sensation, the crunch, the slurp, the melt, the heavenly feeling of cleaning each side evenly with my tongue. Hardness and softness, sweetness and more sweetness, a prism of beauty on earth and above it, and me, the me on the ground, nothing but a giant mouth and tongue, eating and eating for nothing, not one thing except sheer pleasure alone. I don't know how long I stood there in front of the trash can, devouring, licking, swallowing. I only knew that when my mind and body were fully united again, the first thing I noticed was the sour smell of trash in the warm sun. I felt afraid, then a hot shame. It had really happened. I had eaten the whole thing. All that remained was a dribble at the bottom with two sprinkles floating in it, one pink and one blue. I dug them out with my spoon and put that little bite in my mouth. Something had taken me over, possessed me, Some phantom transmitted from Miriam to me, or a demon lurking latent all these years, now suddenly awakened. I had not lost control like that with food since I was 16. I'd thought the demon was dead. No, that wasn't true. I'd sensed the demon in me all along, waiting for the right moment to open my mouth, suck the world down my throat. All of my restriction, my efforts at control, as I tiptoed daily around the edge of hunger, were enacted in the name of keeping that demon shut up. Sleep late to delay calories, write everything down, eat ice, avoid friends. But in all that busy work, I'd forgotten what had made the demon space so dangerous in the first place. When you were in it, it felt fucking great.
Wow, thank you. What a great passage. And I have to thank you for pretzel cones, because I'm a big fan of pretzel cones.
Well, I mean, it's a Philadelphia reading, so I had to bring the pretzels.
Well, there you go. So, you know, there's so much to unpack here, but I'm going to go right to something that really jumped out at me, because I think I'm in a small club with you in that, well, let me back up a little bit. So Rachel, in this book, she, every now and then, she fantasizes that she and Miriam are in the woods in Europe having sex. And this is what's been called, I think I read in one review, a shtetl fantasy. And I just have to say those words, shtetl fantasy. I've written shtetl sex and gotten raised eyebrows from people who idealize and genericize the experience of people living long ago in what were justifiably really oppressive circumstances. But I think people always have sex and have always had all sorts of sex, no matter where or when they've lived or what they've endured. I loved reading the sex scenes that Rachel imagines with Miriam in the woods in Europe. But it's interesting, you know, when you write shtetl sex, a writer transgresses in a way that is different than writing rollicking sex scenes that take place in the here and now. There's a transgression against sacred memory, against an idealized and sanitized view of who our ancestors were. Can you talk about this different, very different transgression and what it was like for you to write it and how are readers reading it?
Sure. So, you know, in writing Milkfed, I discovered that what I had thought were compartmentalized appetites, I had thought that, you know, I had sort of imagined that hunger and hunger was an isolated impulse from sexuality, was a compartmentalized impulse from spiritual longing, and was also compartmentalized from familial yearning and that desire to belong. And what I realized in writing the book was that they are actually all interconnected. And yes, just as universal as it might have been for a Russian ancestor to have felt hunger or the desire to belong or spiritual yearning, so too was their sexual desire. Now, Rachel's shtetl fantasies are just that. They are fantasies. So they are, I think for her, they are definitely a desire to escape from a world that to her appears, she works in entertainment, a world to her that feels fake and internet ridden and very detached from the earth. So it's a very back to the earth, simple fantasy. You know, we have them on the forest floor, we have potatoes, but clearly this is a fantasy. You know, there's no pogroms in the middle of the shtetl fantasy. Right. So in some ways, it actually is its own form of sanitized world. But it's so it's her shtetl, you know, and I think really it symbolizes or reflects her desire to get back to the earth and also her desire for something to connect with her past.
Mm-hmm. Lovely. Really, really lovely. Can you talk to me about writing this book? What was your process like? Did you start at the beginning? Did you start in the middle, the end? How long did it take? Can you just tell us what it was like to write this book?
Sure. So the original germ of the idea for this book was actually a short story that I wrote in college. It was a really bad short story. It's actually probably the piece of prose that then set me to just writing poetry for the next 10 to 15 years. It was bad. But the germ of it was a relationship between two women, one of whom has struggles with disordered eating, and another who is very voluptuous, comfortable in her body, and sort of her antithesis. The woman who struggles, it's her kind of her greatest fear for her own self, but she's very intrigued that someone can have this sort of freedom with herself. I put that story away, and I don't know where it is. But a couple of years ago, I started feeling this longing for the cultural Judaism of my childhood. And I couldn't figure out why I felt so nostalgic. Because, you know, I live in Los Angeles. It's filled with Jews. It's basically Fiddler on the Roof here. You know, it's like a giant Jew. And, you know, we have, but, and when I looked at it, I realized what I felt nostalgic for was a certain sense of the cultural Judaism of my childhood, where when I would go with my grandparents to the Second Avenue Deli, which still exists in New York, but has moved out of the village, or Gus's Pickles, which is no longer there, or Ratner's Dairy Restaurant. And there was a feeling of innocence that I had felt, and a feeling of innocence both spiritually and also in connection with food. Judaism has always been connected to food for me. One of my earliest memories is like building, you know, sukkah dioramas in Hebrew school. You know, there's always been a deep interplay. So when inspired to rewrite the story and starting to think about that intersection between spirituality, appetite, sexuality, the Judaism piece came into play, and I was like, okay, this is the novel I want to write.
I think some of my students might be online, some of my fabulous Drexel MFA students, and I want them to hear that, like, 20 years ago, you wrote a story, you put it away, you kept writing, and wrote all these other great things, and now it's a book. And that's just a wonderful, you know, it's just a wonderful lesson for writers in terms of perseverance, and just how some things, need time to rise, and you let this have its time.
Yes, we can't matzah the story.
That's right.
As much as sometimes I want it to be matzah. Right. You know, I mean, you know, you write novels as well. It's like you want it to be matzah, but it's got to be hot.
Sounds like a good bumper sticker for us. Don't matzah the story. Can I ask you a little bit about the title? Sure. I love the title. I think it's really interesting. I've like turned it around in my head 7 different ways and thought about it all different ways. Can you just tell me like about the process of finding the title? Did it sort of rise up as you were writing? Did you always know this was what it was going to be called? Could you just talk to us a little bit about that?
Sure. The title came to me like all good things do, which is when I was meditating at a Best Western. Love a Best Western, done some of my best thinking there. I was on book tour for the Pisces, actually, in New York. That was also when there's a golem, we'll probably talk about it, but there's a golem in the book and a rabbi. And that was when those two people, I'd say I had written maybe like 5 drafts of this book, but there was no golem, there was no rabbi yet. Mm-hmm. And the golem, the rabbi, and the title all came to me in that moment. And I just like the title Milk Fed because to me, it pertains to appetite. It pertains to the desire to be nurtured and for unconditional love and for a nurturing mother. And you think of a motherland as well. I think our parents are our first gods. So there is definitely something, there is always a religious component to what we are taught by our parents and the way we see the world. And then also, Israel is the land of milk and honey, and Rachel's questions about, you know, her relationship as an American Jew to Israel and her political questions about Israel.
Is she milk fed all along? Like, is it at the end? Is she milk fed? You know, like, is it? Does the title travel with her? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because it's an adjective, right? So it describes her. right? And does it describe her the whole time? Does it describe her differently? Is she milk-fed differently in different parts of the book?
Well, I also, of course, forgot to mention, you know, I mean, then there's also the frozen yogurt component, so which plays a big role. So that's also, you're right.
Very
so,
milk-fed.
Yeah, very milk-fed. So in, yes, every time she goes to Yogood, that's the name of the yogurt shop. Yes, she is deeply milk-fed. And of course, yeah, I think, you know, that's a really interesting question. I think that Rachel would say she is not milk-fed all along, you know, and I think that part of Rachel's journey is discovering that there is a source of milk within her, and she does not need to go, as they say, there's an expression in the book, don't go to the hardware store for milk, right? Like sometimes we go and we go looking for validation or love in a place that where there isn't any, you know, and there's not going to be any. And it's a very human thing to go looking for that. But, you know, it's hard to remember that there's always like an eternal, there is, you know, if God is the ultimate, you know, if God is the ultimate source of the milk, or a higher power is the ultimate source of that, like spiritual nourishment. You know, I think it's difficult as a human being walking around on this planet, not to reach for all different, not to go to the hardware store for milk, not to be reaching for milk and shiny things in all different places. But inevitably, like I personally do believe there is that source within us. It's just so easy to forget. And I think Rachel will probably continue to forget for the rest of her life every day and be reminded, you know, and me too.
Me too. this book, you know, it's about really serious things. Eating disorders, estrangement, I could go on and on. But it's also really funny. And it makes sense to me that Rachel moonlights as a stand-up comic because her interior voice is hilarious. One of my favorite lines is when she's describing past intimacy with another girl and she notices that the girl's tits look just like her own. And she says, I didn't like myself enough to suck my own tits. And I have to admit, I laughed reading it. I laughed underlining it. And I'm laughing. I laughed writing it down on my questions. And I'm laughing now, like saying it again. And do you crack yourself up when you write funny lines like that? Can we like talk for just a minute about the humor in your book? Like, do you crack yourself up? Because I read that and I like just burst out laughing. And that happened all throughout the book. There are so many funny lines.
Well, we have a saying in this household where I live, you know, like the joke comes first, you know, like we live for the joke and live and die by the joke. But sometimes I do get excited when I come up with a nugget. I will say, sometimes I do get excited. But it was actually, I found the stand-up scenes, there are three stand-up scenes in the book, and I found those the most challenging to write. Like, they kept being the least funniest parts of the book. Like, Rachel's inner monologue was so easy for me to write.
Uh-huh.
Her comedy scenes, I mean, do we know how talented she is? She's like, you know, she's funny. I think she's still honing her work, though. So maybe they are not quite on the level of her interior monologue. But they were, I think I rewrote those scenes. Like, my editor just kept being like, no, these are like, she's like, the book is so funny. These are not funny. And I probably rewrote them like, I don't know, 10 times.
Well, they're hilarious. I mean, but you're right. Like, the stand-up scenes are really funny, but her just interior observations in the world are hilarious.
Yeah.
So which is really hard to do. Like, it's, so I really want to just applaud that. Like, it is not easy to write humor, especially in a book that's about serious things. So it was really delightful to read and laugh, especially in these days when like we need things to laugh about. So people who are like on this Zoom, if you need to laugh, it's a really good book. I mean, it's a good book for a lot of reasons. Yes.
It's the QVC portion. Yeah. You know, QVC, where they always make the item look so, they always like touch it. It always looks so soft.
So another question for you. There's a lot of dissociation in this book. Like what you read to us, she hovers above herself and watches herself with the sprinkles. And back in my notes here, I take like really scribbly notes, but I have like a whole column under dissociation of like page numbers where that happened, where Rachel is experiencing something really viscerally, physically, and yet she's somewhere else and she is observing herself. Can you talk a little bit about the dissociation in this book and how it's a tool for Rachel? Dissociation, there, go.
Sure. Well, I'd say that one of my oldest relationships is my relationship with dissociating. I think that it's, you know, I think some writers are great observers of the world. I think that some writers live in a world that is perhaps removed from this world. I would say I probably fall into camp B. And so it's very natural for me to, especially also having a poetry background, I think where so much is explored in poetry through archetype and through through departures. And, you know, and there is this sort of like weave and this circling around, you know, I think it's very natural for me to write a character who is dissociating. I also think that, spiritually, you know, this is really a book, I think, that, I wanted to explore the nature of certitude and, the question of certitude, like, how do we know what we know to be true? And what have we been fed, right? How do we know what we believe is true? And what about when there are two truths held by like warring factions who both believe that their truth is the truth? Can they both be the truth just by the nature of the belief? And so with Rachel's departures and her dreams and her dissociation and her flights and her hallucinations, you know, I think that what my intention was also to create a question as to like, well, what is the nature of reality and truth, right? Like, is truth what we perceive? Is there an objective truth? And so I think, you know, Rachel's dreams, I would say, are just as valid, real, and true as the more objective realities, which of course she is the narrator. So, and she's a bit of an unreliable narrator. So we don't know necessarily that there's objective truth, but yeah, that's how dissociation I think serves.
Yeah, that's great. So I'm going to go to the Q&A a little bit, but before we get to like a question in the Q&A, I just have to read what your Aunt Sharon wrote. It says, "Hi, this is your incredibly proud Aunt Sharon. I'm thrilled to be on the Zoom and so happy that my parents, your grandparents, had such an impact on your childhood. Love you."
Oh, so sweet. Shout out to Aunt Sharon. Shout out to my mom, who is bravely, I think, on the Zoom. It's not easy to have a daughter who writes, who lets it all out there in the wild. And shout out to my mom's friends, Linda, Karen, and whoever else is on here.
Wonderful. I love the love. So here's a question. Do you think Lucy from the Pisces and Rachel from Milkfed would be friends?
Do I think that they would be friends? It's a really good question. And where would they meet? No. I don't. I think, you know, I think it's actually, okay, well, here's, so I think somebody once asked, they were like, you know, your characters seem to like not have a ton, none of them really have a ton of friends, right? Like they're not neither, because Rachel doesn't have a lot of friends. Lucy doesn't have a lot of friends, you know? And I'm like, well, first of all, I'm an introvert. Our characters, I see them sort of as like children. Like they have our DNA, You know what I'm saying? Like, they're birthed from us. So they have our, no matter how different you want to make them, they have our DNA, but you nurture them differently. You raise them differently. But I was also, the child, I was like, well, I kind of like that my characters don't have a ton of friends, because then I don't have to write the friends, you know, like I just have to write a couple key, 1 to 2 key friends, but there doesn't have to be this. So it's like less work for me.
Absolutely. You don't need a whole pack of them there.
No, the whole pack just means more character development.
Right.
And I don't know that they would.
Okay, here's another question. How involved will you be, or are you, in the development of TV adaptations of both of your books? And how has that experience been for you as a writer?
Okay, so I will say that, well, first thing I'll say is that Milkfed was my opportunity to make fun of the experience that I have had in Hollywood. So Rachel works in entertainment, and I had a great time making fun of all of that silliness that goes on. Because there is a lot of, it's funny. I mean, Hollywood is funny. There are so many chefs in the kitchen. When a book is purchased, right? Like when a publisher buys a book, they then publish it. That is how the book industry works. They don't buy books that they're then just kind of like sit on. Hollywood's a very different industry. You can actually live and eat selling projects in Hollywood and never see anything beyond TV or on screen, which is great because there's good health insurance. And that's like why I stay in the game. But it's really with Hollywood, I've learned you have to just be excited about the step you're on. And for myself, I don't think about like, well, what's the next step? Because you just never know if it's going to happen. It's a lot of chefs in the kitchen.
Right.
You know, it's a production. They call it a production for a reason. So with the Pisces, I optioned that to Lionsgate, and I was hired by Lionsgate to wrote the script. But I am just a screenwriter on that project. I'm not a producer. So beyond, I have another producer named Anne Carey, who Lionsgate paired me with. And she was in charge. She's really in charge of getting the director, of casting. They give me a little more input on that than they do most screenwriters. I think because they don't want it to be that the movie is made and I'm like, this sucks. You know, like they kind of feel like they have to keep me like happy. But for the most part, screenwriters, like once you're done, that's it. Like exit, stage left. So that's the Pisces. For Milkfed, that was optioned by ABC Studios. And I am a producer. I will be a producer on that TV show. So I was once again hired to write the pilot as for that. We're taking it out at the end of February to networks. We will see. We will see if it will rise like a holla or not. But with that, I've already started having casting meetings. So that I'm like very, like, I'm going to be much more hands-on and like involved with like the day-to-day making of the show. Whereas with the movie, I wrote the script and they're like, is it like, are you cool if we like cast this merman? But like, even if you say no, we're probably going to like cast this merman.
Right. Okay. Yeah, you know, when we write, it's such a solitary business and you really do have guardianship over all of your words, and being involved with filmmaking is a whole different beast, you know, being part of the team and maybe not even being so much part of that team.
Yeah.
So here is another comment. Somebody is saying, I love Melissa's work and everything that you explore, going back to Meet Heart. Could you talk a bit about how you approach each genre differently? And then this person writes, Milkfed was excellent, devoured it in a day while eating Oreos.
Good choice. Good choice. Yeah, so Milkfed, or Meat Heart rather, was my second book of poems. I come from a poetry background, and I had three books of poems out and then one in the works before I started writing prose. So I would always write poems when I lived in New York until 7 years ago, and I would always write poems on the subway. I like to write in motion. I like to write in places where I'm not supposed to be writing because it sort of derails the perfectionist in me. When I moved to Los Angeles, I could no longer, I was not on the subway anymore, and I could no longer be writing like in my car, you know, because I was driving and you can't like write poems on the 405. So that's the highway. So I started dictating, and I started dictating using Siri and a free note app called Simple Note on my phone. And my line breaks started disappearing, and the language changed and became more conversational. And that was how I ended up writing my book of essays, So Sad Today. So it was sort of like literally the organic landscape changed what I was writing, changed me. Mm-hmm. After I wrote that book, I then got the idea to write The Pisces. And I was sitting on a beach in Venice. The Pisces was like a gift. Like the idea, it was just born to me whole. Like, I mean, many edits went down, but the genesis was just like born to me whole. And so I wrote that the same way that I wrote So Sad Today. I was like, well, I don't know if I can write a novel, but why don't I just try to do like 3 paragraphs a day, dictate the first draft, not clean it up, just like, and I did that for 9 months. And then I had this really messy, cumbersome first draft, but I had a draft, you know? And that's also how I wrote Milk Fed. And also another book that is now in a drawer that I'm like digging out and trying to decide what to do with it, whether it's going to live or die.
Well, we all hope it lives. But if it's not supposed to, we look forward to seeing what stands in its place. I want to go back to the Shabbos table. There's scenes where Rachel goes to visit Miriam's family for Shabbos. And the scenes are really special. She feels so embraced around the table the first time. And then later, not so much. She's sort of, I'm not going to give anything away, but Rachel sort of booby traps her relationship with Miriam's family in a certain way. And I'm wondering about your writing process there. And if you weren't tempted, like, was there a draft in which she gets to stay at the Shabbos table? You know, like, were you, or not? Like, how did that feel for you?
In some ways, her shtetl fantasy is her getting to stay at the so like, you know, two Rachels diverge in a wood, one goes back to Hollywood and like deals with her annoying boss and like makes fake Twitter followers for these, and one disappears into a sort of fantasy version of an older life, you know, a perhaps more simpler, warmer, well-fed life. I will say that the scenes with Miriam's family and the scenes, particularly the Shabbat table, were based when I was 12 years old. I did like an exchange with, I went to a synagogue, Rachel in the book, I did a synagogue much like hers. It was sort of, she describes it as it was more Chanel bag Jews than Talmud Jews, right? So it's like pretty reform. But I did an exchange with an Orthodox, with an Orthodox community in Borough Park. And I was very nervous. Maybe I was 11. I don't know. I was pretty young. I didn't know what to expect. I was nervous. And I was shocked by how much I loved it. It was warm. They didn't come stay with us because we were heathen, but we went and stayed with them. And and it was like warm and inviting and very family oriented, very funny. I loved it. And that really, and I was surprised to love it because I hadn't known that I would feel that way, you know, about a more religious sect of Judaism, but I loved it.
And so that, and then that family and that visit, that memory, that nostalgia you had really sort of guides your hand in creating those scenes and that opportunity for Rachel. That's really terrific and interesting because you do get to go back. You as author, you put yourself back there at that table. Okay, another question here. You had mentioned a golem earlier. Could you talk about how the archetype unfurls in the novel? So golems, let's talk golems.
Sure. Well, this is a great question because actually in my reading life, I'm reading Frankenstein right now, which I'm loving. And actually, I just got a note. Shout out to Christy, my husband's sister. Thank you for coming to the event. My sister-in-law. Okay, anyway, sorry. Golems. So Frankenstein, if you want to know what a golem is, Frankenstein is a golem of sorts. A golem is a figure made of clay or a body made of other body parts. It's basically a body made of inanimate parts that is then sprinkled with a sort of fairy dust or magic or belief or faith or whatever it is that the story calls for and comes to life. So Rachel is trying to quit therapy because her therapist is putting pressure on her to focus on her eating. And before she's allowed to go, if you've ever been in therapy, you know it's harder to break up with a therapist than it is with like an obsessive lover. And you have to do like a final processing session, you know, which I always feel like is more for them than for me. But so Rachel goes there and her therapist asks her to sculpt out of clay. Do a little art therapy, a rendering of what her greatest fears are for her own body. Like, what is she so afraid of? And she sculpts this and she's like, doesn't want to do it, but then she does it. And then she throws it in the trunk of her car and she's like, I'm done with therapy, no more insight, au revoir. Shortly thereafter, she meets Miriam. And at various points in the book, Rachel starts to wonder. Rachel does not, you know, she's not a woo-woo person. She doesn't believe in like, she's not into like the secret or positive affirmations, but she does start to wonder, did I somehow manifest this woman in my life? And, you know, I think that is for the reader to decide, right? Like that is, because I would say like, you know, ultimately Rachel begins to fall in love with Miriam and how real is anyone we ever fall in love with? Like, how clearly do we see them? I often feel that who we love is so much more a reflection of us than the object of our affection, at least in those beginning starry-eyed days. So that is how the golem comes into play. Should I talk about the rabbi?
Sure.
So also, along with the golem, the story of the Jewish story of the golem was the 16th century rabbi of Prague who created a golem to defend the Jews from anti-Semitism. But like many golems, you like Frankenstein, rises from the dead, it helps you, and then you've got like a monster on your hands, right? Like then you have to deal with it. So the two sides. So his name was Rabbi Judah Lo Ben Bezalel. So the rabbi starts appearing to Rachel in her dreams. And I sort of picture him, he has like a Bernie Sanders vibe. Like I really love this character. By the end of my 18,000 edits of the book, the rabbi was the only character I could actually like deal with anymore. Like I wanted to just be rid of the rest of them, but I could still deal with the rabbi.
Yeah, the protective quality of the golem really rings true in terms of who Miriam is for Rachel, because Miriam is protective in some ways. And Miriam never sort of embodies the rogue golem. Like she's just allowed to be protective and then sort of move on. It's really lovely. There's another question. Do you think that Rachel is happy at the end of the book?
I think what I will say of Rachel's happiness is what I'll also say of Rachel's ability to nourish and sustain herself from within. I think that happiness is an inside job. This is my personal belief. Happiness is an inside job. I think it is not something that we can like, you know, we have this self-love industrial complex, I think nowadays, right? Like you go on Goop and you're going to like buy your enlightenment and there's like the spiritual materialism and you're going to sort of Like, it's like that there's some sort of destination to all this, right? Like, you're going to arrive, basically, right? That you're going to arrive in this place of perfect self-love. And, you know, I think in my experience, happiness is not like necessarily somewhere you arrive at. You know, it is moments, and it is always moments. And so I think that Rachel, I would say, has more access to happiness at the end of the book. But I also think, you know, like one's own inner resources, you know, sometimes happiness gets occluded by the bullshit. My dog is on my lap sneezing here. Do you want to see?
Well, I'm glad your dog's there because somebody asked to see Pickles.
Yeah, here's Pickle. He's right here on my lap, my assistant. He's sneezing. That's Pickle. But so he likes to come to these. He's not that impressed though. But So I think that, you know, her happiness, she has more access to her happiness. Mm-hmm. So I think has more access to all of her feelings at the end of the book.
Okay, here's another question. This one is, would Rachel shoplift from Sephora? And if so, what would she take?
Wait, who asked that?
Am I allowed to say?
Yeah.
Okay. Caitlin. You can say Caitlin Dickey.
You know, there's something very interesting happening. So in this other novel now that is back out of the drawer, there is a very strong shoplifting from Sephora plot line. Don't tell anyone. Just in case I do decide to go with this book. Yes, of course Rachel would shoplift from Sephora. I think all of my characters would shoplift from Sephora. I don't think let's put it this way. I have yet to write a female protagonist who would not shoplift from Sephora.
Good. It's good.
Yeah.
That's a good tagline.
but perhaps the next one will finally do it.
Somebody asked, how do you think about the forbidden in your work?
That's a good question. I guess I would say forbidden to whom? I think that, you know, the way that I create is when my first drafts are really like no holds barred. You know, I write to please myself. I want to just be a channel as much as possible. I want to create, talk about like a golem. I want to, coming from a poetry background, one of my biggest challenges in writing prose is like, why would you say in 200 pages what you could say in 2 pages? So for me, like all of that, getting enough girth and bulk is like challenging for me. And so my whole process of my first draft is just like, that's why I dictate, just like, don't edit, just go, right? Like get the juice. And so I really don't think about the forbidden or the not forbidden or the audience or anything, you know, it's just like that unshaped mass. The more that I edit, the further on I get. And this book, I would say that I edited this book more than anything I've ever worked on. This was like, just when I thought it was over, I was like, I'm out of the weeds. I'm just doing like one more copy edit. I was like, I'm back in the weeds. Like, I can't believe that. Like, it was like, every time I opened the editor letter, it was like a minor breakdown. But so editor letters, the notes, the notes that your editor gives you in like a nice letter, and you're like on the elliptical machine and you're like, I'll just casually open this. And then you're like, oh my God, this is going to be like so much work. I thought it was a matzah and it's actually a challah. So yeah. So, but in the end, like, you know, a challah is a much better place to live than a matzah. Like, and also like, what else?
I would take challah any day.
Yeah.
Passover.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah. So I don't think about the forbidden until the editorial process. And then I think I really don't think about the forbidden until it is published. And then like when I find out certain people are reading it, like a former boss or Aunt Sharon or someone who knows me in different contexts, that is suddenly when things I didn't even think were forbidden suddenly become forbidden.
Yes.
Nothing is forbidden at first.
No. Do you write chronologically? My goodness, pickles.
That was my dog being drama. He tripped on the wire. He's okay. Pickle. Are you okay? Okay, he's okay. He's fine. He's dramatic. So do I write chronologically? Yes, I do. Each draft I write and then I go back and edit chronologically. But then like some things will come to me like a new character. And that's, yeah. But yes, I do write chronologically.
So what comes first for you? Character or plot or setting? Like, what do you see first? You see, or is it all mushed up together?
Definitely not plot.
Okay.
In no way does plot come first. In fact, plot is my biggest challenge. Okay. Like coming from poetry to write a novel and then to write a screenplay, I'm like, I can't believe so much stuff has to happen.
I'm very impressed that you wrote a screenplay.
Well, it's just like, but you know, even, but from writing a novel, like narrative drive, it's like, oh my God, like in poem, nothing has to happen. Nothing has to happen for the poem to live. There's like a turn, but it can be like completely internal.
Right.
And then like a novel, I'm like, wait, something else has to happen. So definitely not plot.
Okay. Not plot.
I'm like, when does this much ever happen? Like so many things have to happen. Then I never have enough happening and I have to like make more things happen. Right. Character.
Character.
Yeah. Always.
We have a couple more minutes left. Of course, I have more questions I could ask, but is there anything we haven't covered that you would want to talk about?
No, I mean, this was, Nomi, you're amazing. This was like thorough. I feel like the hour, it feels like, I don't know, I feel like you bent time. I'm so appreciative.
Well, I'll just keep going because we're going to use every minute.
I can see some of the questions from the Q&A. Should I just look in there and take a look?
Yeah. Who are some of your favorite contemporary authors? That's a tough one. Like when people ask me that, I literally forget that I've ever read a book. but anybody you're reading now or somebody that you draw inspiration from?
Absolutely. Actually, I just, I've just read and I loved list. So this is like actually one of my favorite questions if I have like my resource with me. Because
yeah.
I love talking about books. I'm an avid reader. So I will say, you know, different recommendations for different people. Always. You can always check out my Goodreads. I'm active citizen in the literary community, but, I will say some writers who I've read as of late who have really thrilled me. There is a writer named Arianna Harwicks. Mm-hmm. She is published, by a very small press in the UK. That's a press in translation. So her books are Die My Love, and Feeble-Minded. I'm just trying to think of like the most recent, cause I read a lot of dead people too. But like the more recent, another writer named Margarita Garcia Robayo, she wrote a book called Fish Soup. I just finished Edward St. Aubyn isn't super, he's alive at least. I just read the Patrick Melrose novels. I read all five. I liked them. They were good. Let's see. I just want to give you, okay. I love, there's a book called Paul Takes the Form of a Mortal Girl. If you like Milk Fed, I feel like you would probably like that book. I've been going through a big Marguerite Duras phase, but she is dead. Simple
Path. Okay. Yeah. We'll take the dead.
We can do the living and the dead.
Yes.
Yeah. Check out my Goodreads. If you want book recommendations, look at the ones that I give 5 stars to on there and you'll see all my loves.
Awesome. Okay, I'm going to go back in here to the Q&A. Do you see much of a difference between entertainment and art? And which one would you consider your novels to be?
You know, I think that what is entertainment and what is art is truly a personal question for everyone, both for a creator and for an audience. And I think it differs between every creator and every human being in an audience. You know, what is entertainment to some might be art to another, might be both. So I definitely don't have any overarching. Now, I would like to believe that my books are art. Will they stand the test of time? I don't know. That being said, hoping that they do have, that there is some universality of feeling and spirit, which to me is what I look for when I call something art, right? That there is a connection that goes beyond the superficial, that there is a universality of feeling, right? And that's just for me. Mm-hmm. I hope that would be great. That would be really great. I would love that. If not, or if so, I also hope that my books entertain. Like, you don't, like, you know, I mean, I'm like, all right, at least I'm giving you like humor and sex and food. Right. Like, there's something, you know, if it's not art, at least you're probably going to have a good time.
We only have like 2 more minutes, but I'm just going to read you're a real phrase maker. I have so many underlined lines. So one I really liked was my therapist in Los Angeles, Dr. Raina Majoub, I guess, wore sensible clogs and said, insight adjacent things. Like, put on your oxygen mask before helping others. Just that phrase, insight adjacent. And really, on every page, there's something like that. And I think it really speaks to your poetry heart that words are important here, words matter. And you're making new things with words for us. And I'm really grateful.
Words are the only tools I have, you know? I do have this fantasy that one day I'll go to HVAC school, but...
because you want the outfit? Like,
no, because I just think it would be beautiful to know a trade. And I don't know, I've been fixing a couple things around here, so I've been able to lapse into my own fantasy that perhaps I could be good at it, but it's doubtful. But yeah, no, words are the only thing I've ever really like been good at. Like, I'm not good at music, you know, I can't cook. I can't keep a plan alive. Words are my world.
Well, you've shared that world with us, and I wish you lots of luck on the rest of this tour. And everybody should run out and get this book one way or another.
Nomi, thank you so much. That was incredible. Your moderation skills are fabulous, and I really appreciate the deep reading and the thoughtful questions. And thank you to the Philadelphia Free Library.
Yes, thank you, Library. We love you. And Melissa, welcome home to Philly.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.